This is the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. I am here every week at this time. Here's where we talk about what's going on in the economy, what's going on from a policy perspective, and how might it affect you and your money. On today's program, I am welcoming first-time guest to the program, Mr. Peter Schuck. Professor Schuck actually is the author of the book, Why Government Fails So Often and How It Can Do Better. We'll get to my conversation with him in exactly 2 minutes. Professor Schuck is the Simeon E. Baldwin Professor of Law Emeritus at Yale University. Very bright guy, and excited to have him here on the program for the first time. Also, as we talk about government programs, one of those that comes to mind that will affect you if you're planning for retirement is the Social Security program. I'm going to get Professor Schuck's take on the Social Security program and the solvency of the program here momentarily, what some of the fixes might be. But I also want to talk to you today about Social Security collection options. It's a topic that we talk about in detail at our new retirement rules class. I'd like to remind you that we do have one more opportunity this year for you to attend our new retirement rules class. If you have not yet attended the class, I would encourage you to go check out the information you'll find at the website, newretirementrules.com. We have one more one-day class this year. It will be held on Saturday, November the 22nd. Saturday, November the 22nd, the class will begin at 9, and it will conclude at 2:30. The registration cost for you and a guest is just $49. That includes lunch, the books and handouts, everything you'll need. And again, there's information there at the website, newretirementrules.com. You can also register there while capacity remains. When you do attend the class, we give you a personalized Maximize My Social Security report. In the fourth segment on today's program, I'll be talking about different ways to maximize the benefits that you'll collect from Social Security. So I would encourage you to go check the class information out and also get your complimentary Maximize My Social Security report. Again, the website is newretirementrules.com. I'll remind you also that the Everything Financial Radio program is available each week on podcast. If you can't listen at this normal time, you can go to the iTunes store, search under Everything Financial Radio, and you can get the Everything Financial Radio program delivered to you in the form of two podcasts every week. I am pleased to welcome to the program today Professor Peter H. Schuck. Professor Schuck is the Simeon E. Baldwin Professor Emeritus of Law at Yale Law School, where he's held the chair since 1984. He's also served as Deputy Dean. He has a new book out titled Why Government Fails So Often and How It Can Do Better. We want to talk to him about the book on today's program. And, Professor, welcome.
Thank you very much, Dennis.
Let's just jump right in, Professor, because it seems like there is this trend when it comes to government. Well, let's just focus at the federal level. The government is really becoming more involved in our lives, and yet there's this alternate movement that seems that the population is becoming a bit resentful of that intrusion. Can you comment?
Well, I think that's right. The technology and social practices are changing in ways that make us more independent, even libertarian in our approach to things. And so we resent, I think, intrusions of government, and we are accustomed to dealing with very efficient market enterprises throughout our day. And the slow-moving, sluggish, bureaucratic approach to things is often a jarring contrast to that. On the other hand, the society is becoming so much more complex. Our interactions are more numerous and complicated, and so we need institutions that will control the traffic, as it were, and set ground rules. And so government is, in some ways, more essential than ever, but in other ways seems more intrusive and clumsy than ever before compared with the rest of our lives.
So, Professor, that is certainly my opinion, but I'd like your comment, because it seems when you look at how badly the entitlement programs like Social Security and Medicare are underfunded, when you look at a model cities program that was begun back in the 60s, which you can only look at and say this is a dismal failure. Is there anything out there that government does a good job at?
Oh, sure. Lots of things. I have a chapter in which I recount a number of very successful efforts by the government, including Social Security, I would say. Now, the solvency of Social Security in the long term is at risk, but because of largely because of demographic developments. But those things are easily fixed, and I think they will be fixed. Medicare is a much more complicated problem because we have a program built on a very inefficient healthcare system, and just Medicare is placed on top of it and pays and regulates according to the basic outlines of that system. So without changing that system, you'd have to expect that the Medicare edifice is going to be very clumsy, very inefficient, and in some cases even counterproductive. Social Security in particular is a relatively simple, well-administered program. Now, when you turn to disability insurance, which is also part of Social Security, that's a very different program with very serious problems, dysfunctionality, and it exhibits one of the characteristics that affects so many government programs, which is called moral hazard. That's the set of incentives which cause people to behave in ways that are socially undesirable. So we have the Social Security disability insurance encouraging people not to work in order to get benefits when they're on the margin, at which, working is an option for them, and they have to make a decision as to whether they're going to engage in it rather than collect a government check. And the expansion of this program has been very, very rapid, far exceeding any increase in morbidity on the part of the working population. And it can only be attributable, really, to this set of incentives that the government has created.
Well, we are chatting with Professor Peter Schuck, who is the author of Why Government Fails So Often and How It Can Do Better. Let's go back and just look at, for example, you just mentioned the Social Security Disability Program, and I'm sure there are others you could mention as well. How do these programs evolve to a point that they really become ineffective or maybe lacking in social value, if that's a fair statement?
Yeah, there are a lot of different ways this happens. Part of it begins with the incentives on the part of politicians to design programs in ways that favor the interest groups that support them or that they're trying to attract. And so this may be business groups that want the government to subsidize their operations, or that want them to create tax structures that are burdensome on their competitors. It may be unions which want to increase employment for their members and therefore tax us up the taxpayers with those costs. So that's one route. Secondly, there are just lots of unforeseen consequences that are created when you design complex programs in a complex world, and the government is very, very poor at adjusting in light of new conditions. It's a very, very rigid and flexible instrument, and so sometimes these programs continue to operate in the accustomed ways long after conditions change, and the program needs to change as well.
Well, Professor,
so those are two ways that this happens. Another way is that the government is very slow to recognize a problem, and when it recognizes the problem, it imposes a regulatory system that is designed for a problem that's already changed. And so this particularly happens in the area of financial regulation, where the market moves very, very quickly, much more quickly than the government, and so the government's always a few steps behind.
We are chatting today with Professor Peter Schuck. He is the author of Why Government Fails So Often and How It Can Do Better. His book is available at Amazon.com. I would encourage you to check it out. We're going to continue our conversation with Professor Schuck in the next segment. I'd encourage you to stay with us. Everything Financial Radio will return after these words. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen, and I look forward to continuing my conversation with Professor Peter Schuck in the next segment. You know, in the last segment, I was talking to Professor Schuck about government programs that had been successful, and one of the examples that the professor gave for a government program that's been successful is the Social Security program. And he said it's his belief that the Social Security program will be fixed. And what I think he means by that is that obviously we all know that the Social Security program is significantly underfunded. And I want to talk a little bit about the size of that problem in this particular segment. And I want to talk to you about what the numbers are. What is it actually going to take to fix Social Security? And then finally, I want to talk to you about some ways to ensure that you're getting your maximum benefit from Social Security. If you've not yet started collecting Social Security benefits, certainly some information in this segment I think will be helpful. If you're already collecting Social Security benefits, but you're under age 70, some of this information could be beneficial for you as well. So, will Social Security be fixed? And if you believe it will, the question is, what will it take to fix it? Well, a good place to start to figure out what kind of fiscal shape is Social Security in is to take a look at the trustee report. Every year, the trustees of the Social Security program and Medicare programs report on the current and projected financial status of the two programs. And I'll give you just a bit from the 2014 annual report. Neither Medicare nor Social Security can sustain projected long-run program costs in full under currently scheduled financing, and legislative changes are necessary to avoid disruptive consequences for beneficiaries and taxpayers. If lawmakers take action sooner rather than later, more options and more time will be available to phase in changes so the public has adequate time to prepare. Earlier action will also help elected officials minimize adverse impacts on vulnerable populations, including lower-income workers and people already dependent on program benefits. Now, the trustees report says that Social Security and Medicare, these two programs together, accounted for 41% of all federal spending in fiscal year 2013. 40 cents out of every dollar spent by the U.S. government is spent on Social Security or Medicare. The trustees report says both programs, Social Security and Medicare, will experience cost growth substantially in excess of GDP or gross domestic product growth through the mid-2030s. That means that the spending for these two programs is going to grow a lot faster than the U.S. economy is expected to grow. Now, why is this? Well, largely, we've got this whole group of new retirees called baby boomers. There's a lot of them. And we don't have as many folks paying into the system. Now, Social Security has a trust fund. Well, there was a lot of discussion about this trust fund and does it exist or doesn't it exist. The Center on Budget and Policy Priorities put together a piece that was published in August of this year that talked about Social Security trust funds. The report said that there's a lot of political candidates on both sides of the aisle that say this party has raided the trust fund. Well, has that happened? Well, Social Security trust funds are invested in Treasury securities. These are Treasury securities that are specially designed for the Social Security system. So the Social Security Trust Fund has as assets government debt. Now, government debt certainly is marketable, certainly when you see the market, stock market acting in a volatile manner like it has of late. You have people that take their money out of stocks and move to safe U.S. treasuries. But at a certain point, as debt continues to build, the ability of the U.S. government to pay its debt comes into question. Now, the Social Security trust funds, actually there are two trust funds. There's the Old Age and Survivors Insurance Trust Fund and the Disability Insurance Trust Fund. Now, they are distinct, but most times when they're referred to, they just kind of lump them together and people call it a Social Security Trust Fund. Basically, what happens is all Social Security's payroll taxes and other earmarked income are deposited into these trust funds, and all of Social Security's benefits and administrative expenses are paid from the trust funds. Now, what's the current status of these trust funds? Keeping in mind that these trust funds have as assets government debt. Well, Brookings did a study and focused on just disability benefits for Social Security. Now, the trust fund that supports benefits for the disabled is set to run out of money at the end of 2016. In 2 years, if Congress does nothing, benefits for just over 11 million people who are eligible for disability benefits would have to be cut by 20%. Interestingly, those cuts would hit, if Congress does nothing, about the time voters go to the polls and decide who to elect as the next president of the United States. Now, the disability underfunding, the disability trust fund underfunding, I should say, has become a problem really since 1983, and every year the problem has gotten worse. It was back in 1983 that Congress last enacted major Social Security legislation. In fact, at that time, Social Security benefits became taxable for a lot of recipients. And of late, as a result of the economy, there's been a significant increase in workers applying for Social Security disability just because they can't find work. Well, Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff, who was on the program last week, as you'll recall, really outlines this problem very, very succinctly. He says that Social Security needs an immediate and permanent 29% hike in its payroll tax to pay its bills over time. The Social Security payroll tax rate is 12.4%. Increasing that rate by 29% would require raising the payroll tax starting today by 3.6 percentage points and keeping the rate at 16% forever. Now, what's the alternative? Well, you can cut benefits. To achieve long-term solvency via benefit cuts, you would have to cut immediately and permanently all Social Security benefits by 22%. So if you're collecting $2,000 a month from Social Security, you would see your benefits get cut to $1,560. Now, the reality is either of these options is extremely painful. Asking workers to pay more, asking retirees to take less, those are both very politically unpopular decisions. But they need to be made, because Social Security's unfunded liability is just one part of the fiscal gap that the United States faces. Professor Kotlikoff says the fiscal gap of the United States is now $211 trillion. Now, the other part of this Social Security question is, how do you collect benefits? Well, there's a lot of different ways to collect Social Security benefits. If you're not yet collecting Social Security benefits, but you're over age 55, or you're collecting Social Security benefits and you're under age 70, I would invite you to go check out the New Retirement Rules website. The web address is newretirementrules.com. We talk about different ways to collect and maximize Social Security benefits at our New Retirement Rules class. In fact, we even give you a personalized Social Security maximization analysis when you attend the class. If you've not yet attended, we've got one more class this year, November 22, one day only. It'll be held at the East Beltline campus of Western Michigan University. You can get more information or register while capacity remains, again, at newretirementrules.com. We'll be back after this.
Give me your money, just give me money.
welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen, and I have the pleasure of chatting today with Professor Peter H. Schuck, who is the author of Why Government Fails So Often and How It Can Do Better. The book is available at Amazon.com. I would encourage you to check it out. Professor, let's talk a little bit about reform, because for as long as I can remember, and we're approaching a midterm election here, it seems like every politician has run on the basis of some reform, and yet these reforms never seem to happen. It seems like we get even mired down in more bureaucracy. Is there a light at the end of the tunnel here? Do you see that we might actually see some reform, particularly from a fiscal perspective?
Yes, I think so. I mean, the reform occurs, but it occurs slowly, incrementally. As I said before, sometimes it occurs after the nature of the problem has changed or the magnitude of the problem has changed, so that the reform no longer fits the needs of the situation. But no, there is reform. The public has to demand it, and the politicians have to respond to that demand. Now, unfortunately, some of our institutions are very unresponsive, and we see, for example, in the House that gerrymandering has made for a very high percentage of the seats being pretty safe, so that the incumbents in those seats don't have to be as responsive to popular demands as they might otherwise have to be. So the reforms are slow, but sometimes they simply can't be avoided. The Ebola crisis is a perfect example of that. You have a relatively well-run agency, and that's one of the agencies I would cite as being generally quite effective, faced with a new situation for which it was poorly prepared, and public demands for a better response to that crisis have led it to institute some changes much more quickly than it otherwise would have done.
Professor, you made a statement that, in order for reform to occur, the public has to demand it. And with a lot of the guests I've interviewed and just the general sense that I get, there seems to be a lot of apathy out there among the electorate. Certainly when you look at turnout at midterm elections in the past, we've got low turnout. Is the public at a point that they're just willing to put their foot down and demand it? Or would you agree that there's this apathy out there yet and we're not quite there?
Well, there's always apathy. I mean, most people aren't all that interested in politics and not all that interested in government. You know, they've the rest of their lives are very demanding, and they're in some ways more interesting, and they see the results more clearly in other aspects of their lives. So apathy is really a permanent condition, and the question really is whether at the margin people can mobilize and overcome that apathy. And there are times in which the public does that, and much of the action results from the groups to which they belong and the way in which they try to push those groups to represent them in other ways, not just members of Congress, but interest groups, unions, business associations, and other churches and other groups that are active in pressing for social change. So yes, apathy is a perennial problem. The theorists of democracy have certainly, particularly economists, have focused on the problem of public choice, which is based upon the notion that people will act in their self-interest, broadly defined, and people acting in their self-interest may not act as energetically in politics because they're only one person, and the chance of their affecting things are rather tenuous unless other people happen to agree with them. And so that dynamic assures a certain level of apathy. But we also have other dynamics in our system that enable people to mobilize when their interests are really affected.
Well, if you're just joining us, we're chatting today with Professor Peter H. Schuck, who is the author of Why Government Fails So Often and How It Can Do Better. The book is available at Amazon. Professor, let's talk, if we could, about some specific policies that you talk about in your book. And one of the policies that you talk about, or one of the programs you talk about, is the idea of student loans. And as we're recording this, I think the total level of student loan debt is like at $1.2 trillion or something like that. Can you comment on the effectiveness of this program?
Well, it's like many programs, it does a lot of good things. That is to say, you know, when you're spending $1.2 trillion, you know, there are a lot of people who are going to benefit from it. And so it's not surprising that there are a lot of stories of people who whose access to higher education is facilitated by these sorts of loans. The real question is whether they are as effective as they could be, whether it's costing much more than the benefits that the program generates. And there's a lot of room for change and improvement. Unfortunately, some of these changes are going to make matters worse. For example, by creating incentives for students to load up on debt and then hope that they'll be able to avoid the obligation to pay that debt because of certain provisions that have been adopted that enable them to stop payment if they're incomes are low, or if they work for certain kinds of nonprofit organizations. So we'll have to see how that income-based repayment feature of the program is going to work. But you know, there are some reasons to believe that it will be abused.
Let's talk about, as you mentioned in your book, some successful policies. You mentioned a couple things. Let's start with the GI Bill as a policy that's been successful. Can you point out, in your view, why that program has been successful?
Well, the program was successful, I think, under very unusual conditions. First of all, obviously, it was the result of a wartime sacrifice by a very large number of people. Everybody in the country knew or themselves were affected by the war, and people whose lives were disrupted by it. So there was a very widespread conviction on the part of the public that society needed to assure that the returning soldiers would be able to pick up where they had left off, and those sacrifices would be recognized in that way. So that was a very important political impulse and moral impulse behind the program, and it's, you know, we don't see that much anymore. I should also say that some of these programs had some of the negative features that I have described in other programs. So we shouldn't imagine that there was some golden age in which a program like the GI Bill was universally effective. It was riddled with fraud. It didn't reach a lot of people who it should have reached, particularly the minority populations. Often were prevented from using its benefits, and so on and so forth. But it was, on the whole, very effective. Now, more recently, we have programs like the Earned Income Tax Credit, which is a way to support working poor families by having the government essentially augment their income, their wage income, with payments if their family members that is working to support a family. And almost everybody thinks that that's the best way to improve the income of working people. I think it's much more effective than the minimum wage is likely to be, because the minimum wage is likely to reduce jobs at the margin, particularly for young people who are entering the workforce with very few skills at an early age without much experience. Whereas in the Earned Income Tax Credit, the program creates incentives for people who are already working to receive additional income support without employers having to bear the burdens that will cause many employers to either move to technology rather than employ more people and reduce employment or reduce full-time employees to part-time employees and so forth.
So, Professor, explain to the listeners, I thought that was an interesting comment you made that, and I'm paraphrasing here, so please correct me if I'm misrepresenting what you said, but you had made a comment that raising the minimum wage is likely to reduce jobs. Can you expand on that a little bit and explain to the listeners your thinking?
Well, raising the minimum wage is going to help a lot of people who are safely above the minimum wage, and they're likely to be bumped up to some degree by an increase in the minimum wage. And people who get jobs at low skill levels who will be paid more. So that's a benefit to them. But on the other hand, what I would call the invisible victims of the minimum wage are going to be people who don't get jobs in the first place because their value to employers is very low, and the minimum wage, the higher minimum wage, is going to exceed that level, so employers aren't going to hire them. And it will also, as I said before, cause employers to engage in efforts to reduce the number of employees by adopting alternatives, such as moving them to part-time or mechanizing work that can be mechanized. So there will be some beneficiaries of the minimum wage, no question about it, but there will also be a lot of losers from the policy, and those losers tend to be people who are less readily identified and therefore politically less effective in protecting their interests.
So, Professor, last question. If I were to ask you, do you see any trends when it comes to government policies? Do you see something that's emerging that maybe our listeners should be aware of or mindful of?
Well, I think there is a greater insistence, and this is a major theme of my book, in the need to, it seems pretty elementary, but we don't do it very much, of evaluating the effectiveness of government programs before they go into effect and then after they've been on the books and in operation. This would seem like a no-brainer, and it is a no-brainer in some ways, but we do incredibly little program evaluation. Top budget officials of the Obama administration and also the George W. Bush administration have estimated that less than $1 out of $100 that the government spends is devoted to assessing the effectiveness of the other expenditures. And in the healthcare area, they believe that the percentage is even lower than that. So that's really important, and that's something that we can do. We know how to evaluate programs. We have methodologies for that. But we don't do very much, and part of that is because I think officials are not that interested in assessing programs that are popular, but that turn out not to be very effective. That's one thing that can be done. Secondly, I think there are a lot of programs in which the government delivers services through organizations like, for example, in the housing area. A huge amount of our housing assistance is delivered to suppliers of housing rather than to consumers of housing. And so we need to expand voucher programs under Section 8 and programs of that kind, which enable consumers rather than the producers to allocate the resources that the government thinks ought to go into housing.
Well, Professor, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Professor Peter H. Schuck, who is the Simeon E. Baldwin Professor Emeritus of Law at Yale Law School. He is also the author of Why Government Fails So Often and How It Can Do Better, available at Amazon.com. I'd encourage you to check it out. Professor, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Everything Financial Radio returns after these words. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. And thanks to Professor Shuck for joining us on today's program. You know, in the second segment of today's program, I talked a bit about the size and scope of the Social Security Trust Fund and Social Security program underfunding problems. According to Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff, who was on the program last week, in order to balance the Social Security program, in order to bring it back into full funding, we would have to increase the current payroll tax for Social Security from 12.4% to 16%, and that would have to be an immediate and permanent increase. On the other hand, you could always try to cut benefits to balance the Social Security program's budget, if you will. And to do that, it would require a 22% cut in benefits, and that would be an immediate and permanent benefit cut for those receiving Social Security payments. Now, we also talked in that segment a bit about how you maximize benefits from Social Security. How do you know when you're going to collect Social Security that you're getting the maximum benefit? Well, in this segment, I want to explore that to a little greater degree. In fact, I'm going to give you just a bit from a Social Security maximization report that our company published. And I want to walk through some options if you're single and have never been married, if you're married, or if you're divorced, and just give you some ideas as to how you might maximize benefits from Social Security. Now, if you're single and you've never been married, you have a relatively easy choice when it comes to collecting your Social Security benefits. You just have to decide when to collect them. Should you collect them at your normal retirement age? And your normal retirement age will vary depending upon what year you were born. If you were born from 1943 to 1954, your normal retirement age is age 66. If you were born 1960 or later, your normal retirement age is age 67. There is a phase-in period if you were born from 1954 to 1959, and it's 66 and some number of months. Now, if you collect 100% of your Social Security benefit at your normal retirement age, you collect 75% of that benefit at age 62 if you were born from 43 to 54, and you collect 70% of that benefit if you were born 1960 or later. So essentially, you're going to get a 25% to 30% reduction by collecting at age 62 as opposed to your normal retirement age. However, if you wait to collect benefits and delay, say, from 66 to age 70, your benefit will increase by 32%. So if you're going to collect $1,000 a month at age 66, you're going to collect $1,320 a month at age 70. Now, if you're married, the choices are a little bit more complex. Because if you're married, you may have the option to draw spousal benefits from Social Security or your own retirement benefits. You can draw spousal benefits or your own retirement benefits. The spousal benefit from Social Security is based upon the work and earnings record of your spouse. Now, choosing the right benefit at the right time can result in a significant increase in income over your lifetime in a lot of different cases. Now, if you apply for Social Security prior to your normal retirement age, which can make sense in some circumstances, but in a lot of circumstances, if you can, it makes a lot of sense to wait till your normal retirement age to collect benefits because you have a lot more collection options. But if you collect prior to 66 and your spouse is already collecting Social Security just automatically assumes you're applying for your retirement benefits as well as spousal benefits. Now, if your spouse is not yet collecting Social Security benefits when you apply, you can't draw spousal benefits. Spousal benefits can only be drawn if your spouse is collecting benefits or has filed for benefits and suspended those benefits. And when you suspend benefits, you simply say, I'm going to collect Social Security. You go down and file to collect. You then immediately say, I changed my mind. I want to suspend. By doing that, a spousal benefit becomes available for your spouse. Now, generally speaking, spousal benefits are about 50% of the benefits that your spouse would receive at your spouse's normal retirement age, provided you are also at your normal retirement age. So in other words, if your spouse is going to get $2,000 a month at age 66, you're going to get $1,000 a month at your age 66. Now, this can provide a very interesting planning option. And let me give you just a hypothetical example. Let's take a couple. We'll call them Jim and Jan. Jan is a high earner who is 62 years old. Jim is 66 years old, and he's reached his normal retirement age. If Jan applies for her retirement benefits at age 62, Jim can immediately begin to draw a spousal benefit based on Jan's earning record. This would allow Jim to postpone drawing his own retirement benefits until age 70. So Jan draws at 62, Jim is 66. Jim can now draw a spousal benefit on Jan's earning history, and his benefit will continue to grow at 8% per year, or a total of 32% from 66 to age 70. Now, Jan could reach her normal retirement age of 66 and say, you know what, I'm going to suspend benefits. And now they'll continue to grow, and she could have her benefit grow up to age 70 as well. Now, if you're currently single and you're divorced and were married for at least 10 years, you may be able to draw benefits on your ex-spouse's work history once your ex-spouse reaches age 62. There are a lot of different Social Security collection options. We have a program that Professor Kotlikoff actually designed. It's called Maximize My Social Security, and we prepare a personalized Social Security maximization collection report for anybody that attends our new retirement rules class. If you'd like more information about the new retirement rules class, you can visit our website, newretirementrules.com. We have one more class this year. It will be held on Saturday, November the 22nd. Saturday, November the 22nd, it will begin at 9 a.m. and continue through 2:30 p.m. The $49 class registration fee covers the book, all your handouts, and a lunch for you and a guest. So you can register there while capacity remains. Last chance to attend it in 2014. The website is newretirementrules.com. And you can get more information there, or as I said, you can register while capacity remains. Also, the Everything Financial Radio program is available every week via podcast. All you have to do is go to the iTunes Store. When you go to the iTunes Store, search under Everything Financial Radio, and you can subscribe to the Everything Financial Radio podcast, which is actually distributed twice per week. You can also visit everythingfinancialradio.com to listen to any of our past interviews with guest experts. That website, again, everythingfinancialradio.com. That's our program for this week. Sure hope you enjoyed it and got something you can use. We'll be here again next week at the same time. Be sure to tune in. And until then, have a great week.